Who can remember what our theme for the year is?
Renew.
And it's based on the fact that God is a God who loves to renew things, has power to renew things. Everything begins with God, including renewing of things. And renewal involves us turning ourselves towards God and waiting on God. We looked at Isaiah chapter 40, those that wait upon the Lord will renew their strength. And then we looked at the famous passage from 2 Chronicles chapter 7 verse 14. When the people of Israel are in exile and they're away from the land and everything's gone bad and they're in desperate need of renewal, God says, if my people who are called by name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and heal their land, etc., etc. Great promises. And so we then understood that what we need to do is the first part of that is we need to recognize that we need renewal. That's humility. We are agreeing with God about God's assessment of our current situation. And then we need to pray and just call out to God, God, I recognize I need renewal. Please help. And then seek my face. This is about coming to where God is, looking. We want to be with God, because being with God is the place where God can then renew us, right? And that's why this 40 days we're encouraging people to remind themselves that God is with you is so important, because God is with us. That's His promise to us. Jesus said, I will never leave you or forsake you, and I'm with you to the end of the age. So God's presence with us is not an issue. The issue is so often our awareness of His presence with us. It's the absence of awareness, I think Chris Cass posted on Facebook during the week. And so we need to find ways where we can turn our hearts and turn our minds and change our thinking and turn towards God. And then last week we saw that almost always, in fact always, renewal will require a reordering of the priorities in our lives, in the spiritual, relational, physical, intellectual and financial areas of our lives. Because our culture around us is trying to pull things out of order and trying to put finance at the top, or physical capacity at the top, or beauty at the top, or your intellect at the top, or whatever else. But no, the correct order is that the spiritual life is most important. And the process of renewal is that. Confidence that God is a renewing God, a recognition of our need, a calling out to God, and a reorienting of our lives to be with God, and then when we're with God, letting God rechange the priorities of our lives. And when God does a work of renewal amongst people, you get a church. And if it's an already existing church and God does a work of renewal amongst those people, you get a renewed church. And so often when we think about church being renewed, we may think about it in ways that are, if you like, practical. You know, I'm going to go and see if I can find a new church. That's one way of renewing, isn't it? You go and try and find a new church. And you go around and what you'll do is you'll have a conscious checklist, but maybe you'll have an unconscious checklist, and you're walking in and you're making some assessment. What's the building like? Is anybody friendly? Does anybody say hello to me? Are they too friendly? Do they get into my personal space? You know. You know, is the music any good? You know, what are the toilets like? How's the kids' church program? I mean, we assess our experience of church in lots of different ways, don't we? Right. And we might have like an image or a vision of what we think the perfect church would be like. And there's the old cliche: if you find a perfect church, don't join it, because you know. We're not perfect, and we might stuff it up if we were there. But if we're going to have a renewed sense of church, we need to have, I think, a deeper sense of God's vision for the church. Because all of those things, they're like functional things, and they're important things, and they'll help you decide whether or not you stay in a particular place. But they are surface things. They're nowhere near the deeper things that God had intended for when he was creating the church. And so if we're going to be looking forward to a renewed church, I think we need to grasp again, or be reminded again, of God's deeper purposes, God's deeper intentions, God's deeper vision, if you like, for the church. And a couple of years ago, we did a series on Ephesians, and we covered a bit in Ephesians chapter 2. No, it might have been Paul, it might have been me, it might have been someone else. But Ephesians chapter 2, verse 11. Therefore remember that formerly you who are Gentiles by birth and called uncircumcised by those who call themselves a circumcision, remember that at that time you were separate from Christ, excluded from citizenship in Israel, and foreigners to the covenants of the promise, without hope and without God in the world. But now in Christ Jesus, you who were once far away have been brought near by the blood of Christ. For he himself is our peace, who has made the two groups one and has destroyed the barrier, the dividing wall of hostility, by setting aside in his flesh the law and its commands and regulations. His purpose was to create in himself one new humanity out of the two, thus making peace. God's intention was to make one new humanity. The church, in God's eyes, is the beginning of that new humanity. Wow. The church, in God's eyes, is a place where we're supposed to be growing into what God's future intention for all of humanity is, living with each other and with God. That's much deeper than buildings and programs and the handsomeness of the preacher. The church, the local church, is supposed to be an expression of this new humanity. God's calling into an existence a new way of being together, not of division and discord and separation from God and separation from humans, from each other, but a place of peace and blessing and commonality. And whenever God does a renewing work in enough people's lives, they begin to gather together, they will begin to emerge out of that a renewed community. After Jesus had died and risen, he'd been appearing with his disciples on and off, helping them learn that he was with them even when he wasn't visible over a period of 40 days. It wasn't just cold turkey, I'm gone, but he would come and go, and then people like the people on the road to Emmaus, they would recognize, oh yeah, Jesus was with us. We didn't realize he was with us and our hearts were burning. Oh, Jesus is with us when our hearts are burning, not just when we see him physically and can poke him in the ribs. And then he said, wait in Jerusalem until I pour out my spirit. And then, so they waited in Jerusalem, and often what would happen is that the Passover was the first major festival of the year, and then often people would go home and then they'd come back for the second major harvest festival, which is Pentecost in the Jewish annual calendar of events, you know. And people would come from far and wide to go to Jerusalem to celebrate these events. And so that's why in Acts chapter 2, when we've got the day of Pentecost come and God pours out his spirit, you've got this big long list of nations where people are from, right? And so God pours out his spirit and Peter preaches his sermon. And in the end of chapter 2, it says this: with many other words he warned them and he pleaded with them, save yourselves from this corrupt generation. Those who accepted his message were baptized, and about 3,000 were added to their number that day. A lot of renewal happening right there. People from all over the place. People that were just visiting, people that were long-time residents, people from just up the road. But God did something amazing. God did something special, and people hung around. People said, "Well, this is amazing. This is a new thing. This is a new thing that God is doing. I'm excited to be here. I've been baptized. I'm part of this new group." And listen how it's described. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship, to the breaking of bread and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Every day they continued to meet together in the temple courts. They broke bread in their homes and ate together with glad and sincere hearts, praising God and enjoying the favor of all the people. And the Lord added to their number daily those who were being saved. That's a picture of a new thing. That's a picture of when renewed individuals gather together and they're called into this new thing that God's created called the church. And that would have been a wonderful and exciting and intense time, right? And all of the things there are things that are encapsulates all of God's intentions for this new humanity. Everyone being together, people from different nations, people from different socioeconomic backgrounds, people from different levels of education, all together, all in common, and there's joy and there's glad and sincere hearts and there's praising of God and there's learning about God and there's including of other people. If ever you find a church like that, that's the sort of church I want to be part of. That's a renewed church. In fact, it wasn't so much renewed then as new, right? Brand new. But when God's deep intention to create a new humanity, as we saw from Ephesians chapter 2, finds its physical expression, we find the initial description of it in Acts chapter 2. And it talks much more about the quality of stuff rather than the programs, right? It doesn't give you the details of service times or anything like that. But it paints a picture, a profound picture of a new humanity. And we need to make sure that that vision is front and center for our vision of church. Not that it's hip or relevant or modern or contemporary or ancient worship or liturgical or whatever those things might be, the surface things. We've got to make sure that this is the thing that we're holding dear. This is the thing that we're holding core. Because this little microcosm, this little snapshot, if you like, is actually just a foretaste of what it's going to be like when God's completed his project. You know, in the end of Revelation, when it talks about it, it talks about a few things. It talks about there being a wedding of the Lamb, right? And we know that that includes feasting, right? Now, in our society, in our culture, unfortunately, what can often happen is you have a wedding, right? And lots of people go to the wedding, and then a subset of those people, the lucky few, get to go to the feasting, right? That's probably unique in the world, right? You go to almost any other culture, and that's not the case. Everyone that comes to get to the wedding comes for the feasting as well. And it's not just a sit-down meal for a couple of hours often. It often goes for days. And so when we read wedding of the Lamb, which is the joining of God and humans together, and it says there's a wedding, we need to understand that it's feasting. And not just like, you know, a little snack or a few nibbles after the service. No, this is a lavish spread of eating together. Jesus, who is God, obviously just couldn't help doing it, right? And so he would create things like this, like feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000. And there was great, actually prophetic words that spoken to this from Isaiah 25. You can go and read it. It talked about there in that God doing a renewing work and there'd be feasting and God removing the curse of death. I mean, the future vision is that there is this feasting in the future where God completes his work. And then a bit further along in Revelation 21, it talks about the nations bringing their glory and their honour into the city. All of the things that different people produce and make that are an expression of their creativity and their diligence comes in and is shared in the city. And no one has any need. There's no tears, there's no mourning, there's no crying. You see, this glimpse, this snapshot in Acts chapter 2 is just a foretaste of the completed version. But Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost and the subsequent days was a moment. It was a special moment. It didn't last forever. Down the track, persecution came and people were scattered. And the bright beginning met its challenges. This is what it could be like. Now flipped over into the more challenging, how do we work this out? How do we maintain this? How do we continue this? You see, God gives us the vision for it, and God gives us the grace for it, and God gives us His Spirit for it, but we actually have to work it out. And whenever we're in groups of people, there's always complexity. Because it's not just you and God, it's you and your friend and God, and it's you and your friend and your friend and God, and the number of relationships just goes up exponentially. Families would know this when you go from, you know, a couple to having your first child, all of a sudden instead of there being one relationship, there's now three relationships. Right? And when you have the second child, it goes from three relationships to however many it is, four or five, whatever it is. And then if you have a third child, well, it just goes off the charts and then beyond that, right? And so when you're 3,000 people plus the whoever's who added to it afterwards, right, there's going to be complexities and there's going to be imperfect people in there. And so you only have to go a few chapters long in Acts and you see the things. There's the tragic story of Ananias and Sapphira, which is about them not being honest about their generosity, and we weren't going to go to there today. But then there is the case where some of the Greek-speaking widows are missing out on the daily distribution of food. And I find it fascinating that this thing about eating together, the thing about food, is the place where the difficulty came. You see, the Isaiah vision was that there would be a feast together. The wedding supper of the Lamb is that there is a feast together. Jesus did feasting together, and his last meal was important with the twelve. And yet, one of the places where the cracks appeared, where the difficulties appeared, was in the eating together. Was in the distribution of the food. In Acts, with the Greek widows, it was just an issue of organisational complexity. How can we figure that out? And sometimes the vision of God is lost because we don't do the organising well enough. But there are two other instances that are referred to in the New Testament where the eating together comes under attack. The first one is referred to in Galatians, and Paul had been establishing churches in what is modern-day Turkey, and there had been people that were non-Jewish people becoming followers of Jesus. And there was all of the theology about how you work. That was the big theological issue of the day. Can you be a Gentile and be a follower of Jesus? And how do you work out whether, because Jews were not supposed to eat this or eat that or eat the other thing. And could you just go down to the local butchers and buy the meat because it had probably been offered to the idol by the butcher? There was all of these complexities that were going on. And so when Peter was in the same place as Paul, they were eating together with all the other followers of Jesus, whether they were Jew, whether they were Gentile, no matter what. But then some other people came who were a bit more zealous for their Jewish ways. And Peter started withdrawing and not eating with the other Christians who were not Jewish people. And Paul called him on it. Paul said, no, this is not on. God is creating a new humanity bringing the two together, removing the dividing wall. And we can talk about it in all sorts of ways, but where the rubber hits the road is, are we eating together? Are we having a foretaste of the future feasting in our daily and weekly experience? And that was a red flag for Paul. It was something that had to be addressed. It was something that had to be acted on and fixed. And it wasn't the only time. When Paul's writing to the Corinthians, they were meeting together and all sorts of dodgy things were happening. Some people were saying, well, I'm here and I'm hungry. I'm just going to start eating before anybody else comes. And some people were poor and couldn't bring any food, and that was embarrassing them and excluding them. And Paul had some really harsh words to say to try and correct the mistakes. I saw a post on a friend's, Alad Griffiths, of some of you may know, a friend of mine from England, and he said it's really hard to do fellowship in a crowd. In fact, you can't do fellowship in a crowd. You can only do fellowship having things in common, being one with another in smaller groupings. In Acts chapter 2, it was they were gathered each day in the temple courts, and that's great. And they probably heard Peter and the other apostles teaching and all those sort of things. Great in a crowd, but you can't do the one another things there. You can't be sharing how your week's gone, or the challenge you have, or the fact that you've run out of food, or you're sick, or the joys we've had a new baby, or whatever else. You can't share those things in the crowd. You can't do the one anothering. You can't do the koinonia. You can't do the fellowshipping in the crowd. You need to do it in smaller groups. You need to do it around tables. They meet it together daily with each other and broke bread in each other's homes. You see, food. The thing about food is, and the eating together is so important, not because it's just some a rule thing, but because A, it's an expression and a place where everybody needs to be included. It's a foretaste of the heavenly feast that's coming in the future. But it's also the place where you love one another and bear one another's burdens. And someone says, I've got this unexpected bill, and or, can you help mind the kids tomorrow night? I've got an appointment to go to, or whatever else. It's the caring for one another and the loving one another and the enfolding of one another that happens around tables and lounge rooms and homes. And many of you will have experienced, and I've certainly experienced, the decrease in the frequency that our family eats together. And the individualization, the atomization that technology amounts makes it even worse, right? Because now you can be in the same house and you can all be in different rooms and have your different Uber Eats meals arrive at different times. And the drive in our society seems to be eat alone. And our culture is pulling us to eating alone. And the number of individual households is growing, although there's some evidence that they might be plateauing and starting to reverse, but the number of people that are living by themselves is astronomically high in historical terms. And just like last week, we saw that our culture is pulling our priorities out of order and the areas of our life in unhelpful and wrong ways. Our society is also pulling us apart from eating together. I mean, it's just more convenient, right? You don't have to tidy up. You don't even have to cook. You don't have to go to the supermarket. You can just get on your app and a few minutes later, some sort of warm food arrives. That's twice the price and half the quality. But we've lost the vision in our culture of the goodness of eating together. We've lost God's vision for us eating together. Our culture is undermining it. Our culture is pulling it apart. And when we let God do his renewing work in us, we should be finding that stops. That one of the markers of it is that we find that we're eating together. Not just with people who are like us, socioeconomically, or education levels, or life stage, or single, or married, or with kids, or without kids. Now, because that's what people tend to find, right? Even in churches, often single people find it hard to be in community because they feel like they're not part of things because they don't have kids or they don't have a spouse or whatever. But God's vision is for a new humanity. God's intention is for a new humanity where the dividing walls are broken, where the things that the stratifications and the separations that societies always bring about are done away with. And it doesn't matter whether you're Greek or Jew, male or female, educated or uneducated, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free. That was one of the distinguishing features of the early church, was that they ate together across social and cultural barriers. And you could find a slave next to a ruler in the same house having the same meal. One of the things I love about our church is that we love food. And I see and hear anecdotes of people eating together. And that's fantastic. I think that's one of the marks of a healthy church, a renewed church, a church that is living out God's vision for a new humanity, is that there will be eating together. And it can become part of the new normal, right? That our culture says, well, that's really weird that you eat together. Well, no, it becomes part of the new normal. And that's been our experience in Chesn Oikos, is that our Sunday night community meals, it's part of the new normal. That's just what we do. It's part of our rhythm. But we have been thinking about it and reflecting about it. And there are probably people in our church who haven't experienced that, or haven't experienced that to the same regularity that other people have. Or maybe it's just been with people that are like you rather than different to you. And so we want to try and fix that. We want to try and make sure everybody is more included in the eschatological eating together that we practice. Eschatological is just a big word that means the end, right? The things of the end. Where we're going, where it's going to be, we're going to be eating together in eternity. We're going to be feasting together in eternity, and we get to live out parts and glimpses of that now. And we want to make sure every single one here has opportunities to be involved in that. And so we're launching a new thing today, thanks Celia. Called EBC Eats. Now, I can't decide whether it's that picture or that picture is the best one. And maybe we'll just... I couldn't decide, so I thought we'll just go with both for now. EBC Eats. And so what we're going to do is that twice a year, we're going to make a serious effort to get everybody be eating together in homes across a weekend. Now, only twice a year because we know it happens lots of other ways and lots of other times. So we're recognising that. But we want to make a special effort every now and again to make sure that we are all doing it in homes. Not just brunches that we might have in church where everybody can come, but each one of us is doing the one another across the table sort of thing. Because we think that's a mark of what church is. We think that's a important thing about what God is doing. Is that people that wouldn't otherwise eat together, eat together. And so at the end of March, our first EBC Eats weekend is going to happen. And Claire is going to be doing some of the organising of it. And we'll be rolling it out in the next few weeks. But basically, if you want to be part of it, you need to say, yes, I'd like to be part of it. And if you'd like to have it at your place, one of the meals at your place, you need to tell us, I'd like to have one of the meals at my place. And then we will make sure that everybody's arranged in places and times that fit for them. So across that weekend or in the days leading up to it or whatever else, so not everybody can do everything at exactly the same time, but we just want to make sure that everybody is clearly invited and works to be included. Doesn't matter whether you can provide food or not, whether you can afford it or not, we just want you to be together with other people from this church because we want it to live out this little glimpse of heaven. And this will just be a reminder for us in our rhythm of our church. Yes, this is important. Not just in the one-off events that we do every 6 months, but we do it then so that hopefully it renews and encourages and includes new people in this practice of eating together, which is so central to Jesus. I mean, if you take out all of the meal times out of the Gospels, actually they say, if you take out times when Jesus was on a mountain or Jesus was at a meal, you're not left with much. And so we want to make sure that this, what seems like a fragile thing, the experience of the church in Acts and the church in Galatia and the church in Corinth, was that this eating together seems to be fragile. And we want to take steps to make sure it isn't fragile for us. We want to take steps to make sure that nobody is excluded with us. And we want to eat good food together in joy and glad and sincere hearts, experiencing a glimpse of heaven on earth, a renewed humanity, God's deep intention. Let's pray. God, through circumstance or life stage or health or whatever reasons, Lord, it seems like we can be pulled apart. But we ask, Lord, that you would renew in us this new community that you have formed. And Lord, that you would bless our humble efforts to live together and eat together with people who aren't like us, but who are like us because of the common love of Jesus. God, we pray that you would help us to organise it and to participate in it. And we would find that they are gatherings of deep joy and we have glad hearts as we eat together as foretastes of your eternal kingdom. In Jesus' name, Amen.